Hi, this is Summer Brooks, and we're in another episode of Writers After Dark. My guest today is author Jordana Max Brodsky, who has written one of the most delicious trilogies I've read in a long time, the Olympus Bound trilogy, which I will let Jordana explain. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Summer. I love that you called it delicious. That's one of my favorite adjectives for a book that you just kind of want to eat up, which I hope is how you felt.
It is.
Good. Yeah, Olympus Bound is the story of Celine Da Silva, a.k.a. Artemis, the Greek goddess of the hunt, the wilderness, virginity, the moon, archery, and many other attributes. She is living in modern Manhattan, where she lives essentially as a vigilante, hunting down men who would seek to abuse innocent women. And then, much mayhem, mystery, and adventure proceeds from there.
And that is what I was expecting when I first read The Immortals a couple years ago. This twist on ancient mythology, the ancient gods still living in our time, even though their power is diminished from not having quite so many people worship them, they're still immortal. They're still doing what they believed to be the right thing. And then at the end of the book, it transformed into this other, wait, where am I going with this? And the next book in the series, Winter of the Gods, took that to an even broader level. And I had thought that my knowledge of mythology was sufficient. But what you did in Winter of the Gods made me realize, wow, now I understand why people dedicate their entire lives to studying the classics. And then you ramp that up by 11 in the new book, the closing volume of the trilogy, Olympus Bound. And I'm like, whoa, this is unreal, and it's delicious. It's gorgeous. To me, you take the mythology that everybody takes for granted, that you learned in junior high school. You amp it up with some stuff that you might learn in some undergraduate courses. And then you add in an entire planet's worth of esoteric knowledge from long forgotten cults and mystic traditions and mythoses that sometimes you have to take a leap of logic to link them, but you see they are linked. And at one point I just sat back and went, I have to take a break and come back to this because my mind is currently oatmeal. So, and that's what I mean by delicious. There's so many levels to the new mythologies that you've pulled together to make this overarching story that really culminates in time, space, parallel dimensions, and just the connection to the cosmos. And I just have to say, are you yourself a deity for just having all of this in your head?
Man, I wish that were true. That's very lovely. My own experience of writing the books in some ways paralleled your experience of reading them. I think as most people, I had learned my basic Greek mythology when I was a kid. I grew up with Stellaris Greek myths, which I know a lot of us did, in elementary school, and totally got sucked into those basic stories about the Olympians that we all knew. And those really stuck with me for the rest of my life. The idea of wanting to write a book where the gods were still around really was a concept I'd had, since probably middle school. I did a project in eighth grade where I guess it had to be on Greek mythology, and mine was to construct a little miniature cryogenic chamber with pictures of all the gods, and each one had a little coffin filled with glitter, where I imagined that they had all cryogenically frozen themselves after, the fall of Rome, shot themselves into space, and would someday return. Now, that is not the premise of The Immortals, but you can see that the idea started very, very early. And then at Harvard, I took a bunch of classes in mythology, was, again, as you said, sort of expanding my knowledge on the undergraduate level. But, you know, not that much more. And then it was really when I started writing The Immortals that I first became really introduced to the concept of mystery cults. And the Eleusinian Mysteries, not too much of a spoiler, is a major part of that first book, which is something I really had never heard about until I started writing it. And the minute I heard that there was this cult, which, you know, the word cult, of course, having very different connotations back then than it does today, we should think of it more as just a religious sect or a religious society, you know, that this cult had these thousands of worshippers, thousands of members, and existed for thousands of years, and yet nobody ever wrote down what its secret rituals were. They did. They've been certainly lost to time because it was considered, you know, it was on pain of death that you would reveal these ancient secrets of their practices. And so that, of course, to me sparked this concept of, well, that's a mystery novel. I mean, that's a modern-day mystery about the ancient world. And then from there, as you said, in the next book, as I started exploring other cults, and I started expanding my research as well into the Roman era, because, of course, these gods from ancient Greece definitely tie over into Rome. And then the more you read about it, the more you realize, of course, they're all over the Hellenistic world, all over the Roman Empire. And that took me to Turkey and other places in book three. And then where does the science come in? Well, that's part of just sort of the kind of person I am. I think that as fascinating as I find all the ancient stuff, the purely esoteric, the purely ancient, to me, is not as interesting as when you see its relationship to our present day and our present religions and our present philosophies. And so starting in Winter of the Gods, where I deal a little bit with, you know, the origins of Christmas and its sort of pagan history and how that ties into what we do today. And then in book three, where, again, these concepts of even the way that we see the world as modern people with a scientific mindset, that a lot of that goes all the way back to Pythagoras, all the way back to the ancient Greeks. I just sort of think that making those connections, not only is it more interesting to us today as thinkers and as readers, but it also, I think, ties into the entire theme, which is, can you take ancient gods and make them incredibly engaging and interesting as modern characters, modern protagonists, the kind of people we could meet on the streets of Manhattan? It's the same thing as, can you take ancient philosophies, ancient religions, ancient myths, and give them modern relevance as well to the way we live our lives?
Now, your background is actually in the classics, correct? You're a professor?
No, not really.
Oh.
No, I wish. Oh, my gosh. I love when people think that because it makes me feel like I did my job well enough that it sounds like I always know what I'm talking about. No, I was an American history and literature major at Harvard, so that's my background. I actually wrote my thesis at Harvard on Emily Dickinson, Walt Whitman, and the anti-masturbation movement of the mid-19th century. There's a novel in that somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
So that was my background. Again, I did some studying of folklore and mythology while I was there, but it wasn't my concentration. So, and that's it. That's my background. The rest of it all comes from research, reading, and travel. I happen to have a best friend whose parents, one is an ancient Greek professor at Kansas University, and the other is an esteemed high school Latin teacher. And so they become my sort of go-to people when I needed sort of ancient Greek and Latin translations. But now the rest of it is research.
So how much of the research had you already done before you started writing the first book, The Immortals?
A lot. I mean, The Immortals was written over the course of, well, I mean, once you put in all the different drafts and rewrites, you know, many, many years, although it went relatively quickly, in part because it was being written, you know, about New York City where I live. And so the research that one does for setting and place and those kinds of details was quite easy because I was right here. The mythological research, again, in The Immortals, a lot of it was stuff that I had known for a long time, so just adding in the Eleusinian Mysteries component wasn't too terrible. The other books, I did a massive amount of research, but I only had a year to write each one because of the publishing deadline.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to just get it all done. I'm a fast reader, so I guess that helps. And I did do a lot of traveling. So I actually went to Greece and Italy before I wrote The Immortals, and then I went back before Olympus Bound and went to Italy and Turkey. Oh, actually, Italy again, Turkey and Greece again, actually, so that I could see the rest of those sites. I actually wound up hiking Mount Olympus as part of my research for Olympus Bound.
Mm-hmm. And I should tell our listeners that your website, JordanaMaxBrodsky.com, has some lovely pictures of all these places that are actually used in or inspired usage in the at least the last two books.
Yeah, and the first one as well. I've got pictures of, the Immortals. A lot of the Immortals is about secret spaces within New York City that are sort of attractive to the gods and to the different cults. And so a lot of those spaces as well, I've tried to put some of those in the website too.
Nice, nice. Now, I have to ask, where did the inspiration for the connection with Pythagoras, mathematics, and music come from? Because that, I got giddy when I started realizing where that was going.
Yeah, and I don't want to give too much away, of course, because a lot of that is part of the climax of the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's so funny. The research process becomes such a tangled web of overlapping threads that it's actually kind of hard to even trace my way back to where did that first bit of inspiration happen. Probably part of it, my husband is he's many things, but one of the things he does is he teaches math and science. And so part of it actually came from him. A lot of it, it's interesting, one thing that actually isn't in the book at all, but was originally the entire conception for the book and got thrown out, was the Antikythera mechanism. And so starting with that eventually led me to other sorts of ancient Greek mathematics. And so it's sort of, my husband kind of talked to me about the Antikythera mechanism. Have you ever heard of that? Do you know what that
is? Yeah, that's the ancient computer they found at the bottom of the Mediterranean. They're like, wait, this is a computer.
Right, exactly. So it's all made with gears, and it was essentially an astronomical computing device, and it could predict eclipses, and it could predict eclipses far into the future, far into the past, along with the, you know, location of the stars, the planets, the constants. I mean, it was amazing. And I thought, well, this is great. And again, a kind of a big mystery of what exactly does it do. And I was determined that the mystery of the book was going to be figuring out, you know, how to use the Antikythera mechanism to predict some great cataclysm that the gods might have to stop. And the more I researched the Antikythera mechanism, the more I found out that just in recent years with new imaging technology, it actually isn't that much of a mystery anymore. We pretty much know how it worked and what it did. And I was like, oh, well, okay. But again, in that sort of quest, I wound up coming across all this other stuff about mathematics, and wound up reading about Pythagoras and then finding out that Pythagoras's stuff, you know, we think about the Pythagorean theorem as the most important contribution he made, but it really isn't. The real contribution was his understanding of the mathematical ratios that underlie musical harmony. And once I learned that, and learned that there is a theory that, you know, that first time, at least first recorded time, that mankind understood that mathematics underlies our, like, observable experience of the universe, that was this huge leap forward for mankind. And it's all, but all of our present science is really based on the idea that you can use formulas to predict the action of the stars or the action of a dropping ball. All that is kind of amazing. And so that's sort of what led me down the path.
Nice. Well, I found the Immortals to be completely engaging. And then having my mind blown consecutively in Winter of the Gods and Olympus Bound, it was just, you know, you combined math, science, music, ancient Greek gods, ancient Roman counterparts, and just a mystery that started in Manhattan and spread to the ancient world. I'm like, this is just fascinating. And the fact that there's all this world building, but you still have characters that you care about. I mean, there are very, very, quite a few places where you feel Selene, who's Artemis, you feel her pain, her hesitation, how she's cut herself off from humanity while still interacting with it. And then this story just brings her back into being with the world. And I thought that journey was just as important as her having to stop, shall we say, the rampage of her relatives.
Yeah, for sure. That was very important to me. I am not actually a reader who normally reads a whole lot of mystery books or thriller books. That's not usually my cup of tea. And so writing The Immortals as a little bit, you know, in some ways, it's a, you know, kind of a procedural mystery, a little bit at least, was a challenge. I did it in part because it felt like, as the goddess of the hunt, that made sense for Artemis. She should be tracking down a killer. That's the whole point of her as a character. So that's where the book wound up taking me. But it was incredibly important to me to make it, at heart, a story about human interactions, humans in this case including the divine, so human immortals, their interactions, to make it about relationships and about, in some ways, a bit of a coming-of-age story, even though she's 3,000 years old, because she's the goddess of young women and she does have, in some ways, this sort of stunted psychological growth because she is so isolated and she's still clinging to the past, I wanted to have a story where you saw her begin to expand her horizons.
Mm-hmm. And I'm a huge fan of thrillers, and each of these stories does have the ticking clock to battle against. And I love stories that are mashups, genre mashups. So you have the thriller fantasy, the thriller, the science fiction thriller, the science fiction space opera murder mystery. Those kind of stories really, really grab me because it takes elements from each of the genres I love to read, and when they're mixed together well, it's literally an unforgettable experience. That first time through, where you're following all the pieces, you have the fantasy elements in there that are so familiar and comforting, but then another part of your brain activates as you're following the breadcrumbs, trying to solve the mystery or unravel the plot, just as the main protagonists are, and it's fun. It's completely, thoroughly engaging.
Well, I think I felt like if I was going to delve into these broader and more complex themes of mythology and history and religion and science and identity and femininity and all these things that I really wanted to tackle in these books, if I was going to get anybody to pick it up in the first place, there would also have to be a thriller sort of involved. There'd have to be a ticking clock and a page-turning aspect to it. Otherwise, you know, I think it's a hard sell. I don't mean that just commercially. I mean to any reader. You know, it's a rare, maybe a niche group that's like, oh, yeah, I want to totally read a book that's just about, you know, mythology and identity. But if you throw in some murder and mayhem on top of it, it does, I think, make it a little more palatable.
Mm-hmm. But you
I'm
have
glad to hear that. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
But you have to have a character that you connect with and you care about. And I think you've really, really hit the nail on the head with Celine and her, you know, evolving relationship with Theo.
Right. I mean, Theo is the classics professor who becomes sort of her, in some ways, her sidekick, her partner, her, you know, crime solving partner. That was important to me. I always think that, you know, I always wind up following the human story, the human relationship in a book. It's what gets me to turn the pages. And so even though you have a ticking clock and a, you know, possible catastrophe down the road that we need to resolve, it also is that human story that I hope is what actually gets people to want to keep reading. Mm-hmm. And as for the genre conflation, that was a really tough part of the book. In the original drafts, I had a lot of comments from my agent and so forth saying, you know, what genre is this? It doesn't really fit easily. You know, how are we going to sell this? And a lot of people wanted me to kind of take it in one direction or the other, and I kept resisting because I felt like there was a way to be able to have my cake and eat it too. And I always feel like I'm starting to bite off perhaps more than I can chew, especially as, like you said, in the third book, you start putting in all of these additional aspects of mathematics and science and everything else. But in the end, I feel like, you know, you persevere and you keep working at it, and it can actually make it, hopefully, into a seamless whole. At least that's the goal.
And every time I come across a story that combines genres, and it's so good, and I wonder, why is there such hesitation when it, you know, to me, those are the better stories. And I realize it makes it harder for the marketing people to I was like, well, I have to pigeonhole it or else we don't know how to sell it. I'm like, you know what?
Right.
You know, there's keywords, metadata. People are searching on stuff, and if it comes up on several different searches, it's okay.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think that's very true.
Yeah.
I'm trying to start a new genre that my book would fall into, which is godpunk. And I didn't coin that term, but I think godpunk kind of sums it up as just a, look, it's all you need to know is that there are gods in mythology, but it's, you know, modern and strange, and then take it from there and see where it goes.
Huh. I would have to say that Neil Gaiman's American Gods might fall into that, and seeing how successful that TV show adaptation of his book has become, yeah, you're probably onto something there.
Right, absolutely.
And you know, if stories like this and shows like that get people more interested in relearning, reconnecting with the classics, I don't see that that's a bad thing, because there's one of the heartbreaks of my life is that it seems that more and more people know less and less about history. I'm like, really? How can you not love history?
Yeah, I feel the same way. Definitely history is my first love. And my next couple projects are definitely even more history-based. Even Olympus Bound, the original, The Immortals, before the brutal editing process, you know, I had a whole bunch of flashbacks to Celine and her history of her 400 years in New York City. So Celine in the colonial era, Celine in the Civil War, you know, sort of getting to see her in these different moments. And I think it was all for the best that they got cut out, because they don't slow the plot down anymore. But I love that. I love being able to sort of explore her past. And to give people, even New Yorkers, you know, we live in this city that is so modern and so moving forward all the time. I think we forget that New York is, you know, one of the oldest big cities in America. It goes back to the 1620s. It's older even than Boston. And the history is all around us. And I think that, you know, we sort of block off our minds to it. And I love being able to open those horizons for people.
Now, was Celine always your first choice for the protagonist?
Oh, yeah, it was always going to be Artemis, no question. I think I'm not alone in being drawn to Artemis as sort of my quote-unquote favorite goddess. I don't know, who was your favorite goddess when you were growing up? Or god, for that matter.
Diana, Artemis, yeah. And then,
yeah,
like, right,
yeah,
very, very close behind was Athena. Just,
sure,
you know,
exactly.
The fact that she
always
was...
Artemis and Athena.
Yeah. The fact that she combined wisdom and the warrior, I'm like, yeah, that's me. Yeah, I like that.
Right. At least it's what we all want to be. Even if we aren't, I think we all strive that concept of being a fierce, you know, kick-butt warrior girl when we're young, especially, is really attractive. And the more I thought about it, the more I was drawn to the concept of Artemis in the modern day, in part because of the whole concept of virginity and celibacy. And, of course, both Artemis and Athena are celibate goddesses. It always sort of drives me crazy in the Percy Jackson books that they have Athena having all these kids. And I was like, wait a second. she's supposed to be celibate. So I think it's interesting that, you know, why are these two of what we would consider sort of the most interesting and strongest of the goddesses, why are they cast as virgins in the ancient world? And, of course, it made sense back then that they didn't see how a woman could be a huntress, right, a warrior, and also be a mother and a wife. Those things just did not compute in the patriarchal society of ancient Greece or Rome. And they actually, however, today, obviously, we no longer think that, you know, femininity and ferocity are mutually exclusive. And so we imagine that our Wonder Women or whatever, you know, don't have to be virgins anymore. And so I love the idea of Artemis still clinging to her virginity for the past 3,000 years, and now finally having to start to question that decision and figure out how much of this virginity is truly part of her identity, this exclusion from physical love, exclusion from men, etc., and how much of it is sort of a holdover, a self-imposed, or perhaps imposed by a patriarchal society that was actually being in some ways sexist, even though at the time that was the vision of female liberation in ancient Greece was being a virgin, and we no longer think of that today. So I was interested in that paradox and how that would evolve over time.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because I used to wonder, you know, in college when I was reading just a little bit of everything, I used to wonder what led to the separation. You have what is it, maiden, mother, warrior, and crone, or sometimes it's just maiden, mother, and crone. Why are there four separate aspects? It's like they're pigeonholing those aspects so they can't be more than one. And I'm like, was that a way of trying to control what women could be from the patriarchal view, or did somebody just, you know, make a mistake in taking notes? And it always fascinated me why that had to be, you can only be this and not any of the others. Why couldn't a goddess or the goddess be all of them? Because they are aspects of her. Who says she can't be all of them at the same time?
Right. And you notice they never do that to the men. There's never a sense of, boy, soldier, old wise man. Like, no, that's not it. But the minute you say, maiden, mother, and crone, everyone has an immediate sense of what you're talking about. And I think you're right. I think you're right on the first count that it's essentially a way to control women. To pigeonhole them into these different groups. And I think what's interesting to me is, of course, we are still absolutely fighting those exact same boundary lines in 2018. Right? In many ways, we're like, no, we still have that. You can either be this, that, or the other. You can't really be all of those at the same time. Without coming in for some sort of societal condemnation, or at least societal, rolled eyes.
So hopefully better stories and more imaginative reinventing of myths and heroes and legends can help future generations get over that and just roll their eyes when they look back at us and they go, really? Y'all are still, really? Seriously?
Right. Exactly.
So what deliciousness are you working on next?
Well, I'm actually almost finished. I'm sort of neck deep and just sort of finishing up here with my next book. And it's not Greek mythology, but it does have a fair amount of overlap sort of thematically. It's actually a bit more historical fiction, but it's definitely still in the godpunk genre. It's going to be published next year, and the title is still to be determined. And it's actually about Inuit mythology and Norse mythology sort of combined. So it follows an Inuit shaman in 1000 AD in the Canadian Arctic who winds up encountering the Viking explorers who are coming to settle present-day Newfoundland, which is all, of course, actually true, Leif Erikson's family who came and did that. And so you have a conflict between the Inuit shaman and the Vikings that she meets, as well as the Inuit gods and spirits and the Norse gods as well, who are sort of coming with their followers to the New World.
Interesting. I like it.
So definitely expanding the horizons here beyond the usual Western canon.
Yeah, because there's so many cultures with their own mythologies and legends that don't have enough exposure through North American entertainment, be it literature, television, movies, what have you. And some of them are absolutely fascinating. And we need more of it. So thank you for going the Inuit route. That's one that's sorely overlooked.
Yeah, the minute I sort of started researching Inuit mythology, and I did not know much about it at all when I started, and I found this unbelievably rich world. And of course, I shouldn't have been surprised. The Inuit culture is still very much alive and thriving throughout the Arctic world, in Canada, Greenland, and Alaska. And so you actually have, an indigenous folklore, indigenous mythology, indigenous religion, which is, again, still very much being taught and told and worked with, which is wonderful, because when you think about the ancient Greek stuff, I'm trying to go back to things that were originally, stories that were transmitted orally thousands of years ago, eventually written down pretty much by the Romans, and then much of which was then lost to time, and we have these sort of bits and scattered fragments. And with the Inuit stories, to a certain extent, of course, the similar story. You have an oral tradition that was written down primarily by originally sort of, Anglo-European or Scandinavian-European anthropologists who were encountering the Inuit usually around the turn of the century. But because those, you know, Inuit communities are still around, again, the stories are also still very much alive and vibrant.
So have you had to go up into the Arctic Circle to do some research firsthand?
I am about to, actually. Oh. I'm about to. I would have loved to have been able to do that at the beginning of the writing process, which would have made a lot more sense. But turns out getting to the Arctic is extremely difficult. Getting to Greece and Turkey, much easier. So it's taken me all this time to be able to even get up there. So I'm actually heading up in just a few weeks. I'll be up in the Canadian Arctic for a while, doing a little bit of research and seeing the landscape firsthand, meeting with Inuit people, and having conversations, et cetera, you know, doing all that I can to kind of get a bit of a more firsthand knowledge of it.
Are you going to get a chance to visit any archaeological historical sites?
That's a good question. It's not quite the same. Again, it's not like in Greece where they're all marked on a map and you can, you know, pay your entrance fee. The archaeological sites that are up there, on the one hand, there actually are a lot of them. Because of the Arctic environment, things do get preserved, but what would be preserved is primarily maybe a circle of stones that at one point was the base of like a sod igloo for an earlier culture, that kind of thing. And that's what you'd really be able to see. And I'm not quite sure that I will actually get to see one of those. It'll be March, and so probably it'll all be under snow and ice anyway. So I don't think I'll actually get to see those, but that's okay. I'll see what I need to see, hopefully.
Awesome. Well, good luck with your research trips, and I assume you'll take more photos so that we'll have something to look at when the next book comes out.
Oh, for sure. I have a very obliging husband who brings the camera and takes most of the pictures for me, which is very nice. And unfortunately, the one archaeological site that is something I'd love to visit, but unfortunately is not actually easy to get to when you're going to the Arctic, is the Viking settlement in Newfoundland, which we do still have the remains of their longhouse, which has been uncovered by archaeologists on the tip of Newfoundland. And you can go there, and I am dying to go. But unfortunately, again, it's not really on the way to the Arctic in any kind of useful manner.
That would be a destination for a second trip and maybe a camera drone.
Yeah, for sure, right? That would be amazing.
Cool. Well, Jordana, thank you for sharing your enthusiasm and love for mythology with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for all of your fantastic questions. It's always wonderful to meet somebody else who is as excited about these things as I am.
The book, the newest book, the conclusion of the trilogy, Olympus Bound, is out from Orbit. And is it out March 6th?
It's already out. Actually.
It's already out.
It's out on February 13th. Yeah, that's right. It's in hardcover and audiobook. I actually read the audiobook myself.
Nice.
Along with Robert Petkoff, who reads the CEO chapters. And yeah, so it's out in both hardcover and audiobook right now.
Excellent. I recommend, if you are a fan of mythology and mystery thrillers, this should be right up your alley. The first book is The Immortals. The second book is Winter of the Gods. The third book, Olympus Bound, is out now. The fact that the story in all three of these books takes place over about a year, year and a half, just blows my mind. I mean, those folks are tired.
Yeah, I think she's going to deserve a nice rest after this, for sure.
Okay, we will have links to the books where you can check them out yourself. Again, thank you, Jordana.
Thank you, Summer.
And we'll be back with more Writers After Dark in just a minute.
Hey, you. Stop hiding behind that sofa. Come out from back there. Your sofa wants to talk to you. Wants to play footsie with your mind. Listen to it. Relax. Let it in. Starship Sofa. The first podcast ever to win a Hugo Award. With weekly stories from the world's best authors. Michael Moorcock, Peter Watts, Joe Haldeman, Peter F. Hamilton, and many, many, many more. With news and reviews and interviews. Bradbury, Pole, Wolf, and Mieville, the sofas chewed the fat with them all. Facts and fictions, articles and particles. Oh, why aren't you listening? StarshipSofa.com. Your best science fictional fix this side of the coffee table.
Thank you for listening to Writers After Dark. And if you have any questions or comments you want to add, please feel free to send an email, summer@writersafterdark.com. Or if you want to call in and leave a voicemail message, we're using the same number as Slice of Sci-Fi. The number is 602-635-6976. Don't have any links to iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play yet, but they are on the way. And as soon as we have those links, they'll be in the show notes and you'll be able to find the show on those different platforms. You can follow the conversations on Twitter. It's @writeafterdark over there. And of course, there's the website writersafterdark.com. And for your media coverage, television, film, web series, and the like, you can check out more fun stuff over at sliceofscifi.com. If you want to support this show and all of the other shows and websites that we're cranking out here, you can help by going to our Patreon page and pledging. That's patreon.com/sliceofscifi. And thank you in advance for your support. I'd like to throw a shout out for the music we have here on the show. It's Archaics by Simon Quest featuring Shy Dawn. We have the links to other works by both of them, so check those out. Support indie artists and everything they do. Thanks again, Shy Dawn, for getting this theme music together for us to use right here. But that will do it for this episode of Writers After Dark. See you next time. And remember, keep looking for your own stories.